Andrew, herbicide-resistant weeds are no laughing matter, but I had to smile when you were showing that slide of the hand weeding, because every challenge presents an opportunity, and I've got three teenage and college-age boys, and they saw this as an opportunity, and so they put together a little consulting firm and rounded up groups of 10 high school kids and put them to work in fields, and they managed the crews, and they actually made a good bit of money off it. But so every challenge presents an opportunity. What I want to talk about is integrating targeted conservation in production systems and the role of non-crop elements in agricultural landscapes to enhance soil and water wildlife opportunities, as well as economic opportunities for producers. So I'm going to talk about precision conservation for riparian systems to maintain a balance between soil, water, and wildlife conservation, plus economics. And I'm going to focus on forest riparian buffers specifically, but this more broadly applies to targeted conservation buffer practices in general. And so when we think about the conservation benefits of riparian forest buffers, I'll just call them conservation buffers, we know they do many things from a soil and water quality standpoint. They, with regard to surface water, they slow velocity of runoff, filter surface runoff, intercept sediments, nutrients, and pesticides. They intercept and retain nutrients in as well in shallow subsurface water flows through the root system. They have in-stream functions as well. They slow out-of-bank flood flows. The roots stabilize and hold banks, increase resistance to stream banks to erosion. The woody vegetation lowers temperature in streams, which is important for many fish species and other aquatic life forms. And then they provide alloctonous inputs into the stream and affect the faunal community in the streams. They also provide terrestrial wildlife benefits. The herbaceous and woody vegetation associated with conservation buffers provides food and cover for wildlife. It provides habitat for pollinators, as well as increasing landscape connectivity. Additionally, it provides other benefits like sustainable sources, timbers, carbon sequestration, etc. But the point is, these non-crop elements are part of our agricultural systems, and they're an important part, and they provide real, measurable, and tangible environmental services that need to be considered and intentionally developed as part of a managed landscape. And so just to provide an illustration, this is a landscape in central Mississippi, 1999. These are two streams there in the middle of the slide, the Hanging Kettle Creek and Town Creek. There were impaired waters based on DEQ and EPA criteria. And you can see why they're impaired, because we've got pasture land in the uplands and then row crops along right along the creeks. And there was gully erosion in the pastures. The water off the pastures was flowing across the bottoms, carrying a lot of real and surface erosion into the streams, and water quality was terrible. And so we went in 1999 and over a series of years systematically implemented riparian forest buffers coupled with other conservation practices to buffer and protect this whole stream. And so looking at the changes in the stream over time, this is by 2006, you can see the areas fenced out and developing. By 2012, you can see those riparian forest buffers well developed. And again, these conservation practices were not done in isolation, but instead on this 5,000-acre producer, they were part of a conservation management system. And so in this slide, all the colored polygons here are actually conservation practices that either are taken out of production or they're in conservation practices, like those triangles of yellow in the north east corner there, or northwest corner, are actually native warm season grass pastures that were established, and they're part of his grazing system. But the point is, riparian forest buffers are a part of an intentional part of a designed conservation management system in a managed landscape. Riparian forest buffers, though, don't always produce all the outcomes that are desirable. There were a lot in the southeast where much of the riparian forest buffer enrollment occurred. A lot of buffers just went in as 180 feet of pine trees on a creek. and pine trees on a creek and aren't necessarily a designed riparian forest buffer. And so wind buffers are designed in accordance with Standard 391 that includes the three zones, each serving their own particular function toward the resource concerns and the desired outcomes, then riparian forest buffers can have substantive conservation benefits. So we've got the tree zone next to the stream that provides the root structure and the shading that protects the stream bank as well as the in-stream areas. We've got the shrubs that trap flood debris, that provide additional bank stabilization, provide an alternative wildlife habitat. And we've got the outside grass strip that slows the water entering the buffer and does a better job actually than the trees in filtering and trapping sediments. And so this three-zoned approach to a designed riparian forest buffer that has this feathered edge is really the structure that we're looking for. And that looks like this on the ground and produces substantive benefits from an environmental standpoint. But the benefits vary in relation to how it's designed. And so when you consider water quality, for example, the efficacy of that buffer in enhancing water quality depends on whether it's appropriately zoned, the plant materials that are used, the buffer width, the hill slope position, the slope length, the erodibility of the soil, the type of drainage on the field, whether it's surface drainage or whether it's subsurface, the geomorphology, all these things affect the efficacy and subsequently should be incorporated in the design. From a wildlife standpoint, the characteristics of the landscape as well as the buffer also influence the efficacy in achieving conservation benefits focused on wildlife. Buffers are wildlife species or guilds have unique habitat requirements. And so one plant community is not going to be equally beneficial to all species. And so if there's focal species in the landscape that are part of a larger landscape conservation initiative, then the plant materials elected ought to be structured around the habitat needs of those species. Again, they need to be appropriately zoned. They need to have appropriate structural and floristic diversity, not that 180 foot of pine trees on a creek. With regard to width, from a wildlife standpoint, wider is always better. But what may be as or more important is the total percent of the landscape that's in habitat may be more important than width per se. And then the landscape context that it fits in and how that influences connectivity. And from a wildlife standpoint, just the habitat area plus the connectivity are two of the most important functions that riparian buffers provide. And then how the practice is maintained. Now, having said all that, conservation buffers are practical conservation practices. They're cost-effective. They can be targeted. They provide multiple environmental benefits. And when they're well-designed and strategically deployed, they do produce desirable environmental outcomes. And those are disproportionate to the change in primary land use. It's one of those practices that a relatively small change in land use, 3%, 4%, 5%, can produce a relatively large change in desired outcomes, 15%, 20%, 40%, 50% enhancement in wildlife population, or reduction in nutrient transport, or reduction in sediment transport. Now, in general, because most of these practices are implemented under some conservation program, the potential placement of the buffers within a field, watershed, or landscape is constrained by practice eligibility. But the optimal placement in a landscape is going to vary in relation to the specific resource concern. And this is where precision ag technologies come into play. We use, at the field level, precision ag tools like remote sensing, soil moisture sensors, on-the-go sensors, tissue sampling, grid soil sampling, etc. We use those to inform our decisions on infield practices. But we can also use many of those same technologies and tools to inform our decisions at the landscape level when we recognize that there's larger processes, that those infield practices or influence and processes at a landscape level, and those fields are actually a part of a larger integrated system that occurs both above and below ground. When we have that kind of interconnected perspective and an ecological emphasis, we can use the same kind of precision ag tools to design precision conservation if you will. So here's an example. When we consider water quality, critical areas contribute a disproportionate amount of sediment and nutrient pollution to our water bodies. But when you look at all the conservation practices, buffers, for example, that are put on landscape out there, Osmond in 2012 reported that less than 25% of those buffers actually were placed in the critical areas where they were really needed. And so they have a disproportionate effect, but that disproportionate effect would be much larger if we put the practices where they needed to be most based on measurements of resource concern. So precision conservation tools like LIDAR and derived terrain models, land use, land cover data, BMP efficiencies can be used and have been used to identify not just desired but optimal buffer locations. So a good example, this was a nice paper by Tomer that used precision conservation tools in a geospatial context to inform placement about where, given all the places conservation buffers could go, where they would achieve the most or greatest environmental benefits from a water quality standpoint. We can do the same thing from a wildlife standpoint. The habitat quality of a particular conservation practice is going to be a function of usable space, total habitat area, patch size and configuration, landscape context, plant community connectivity, etc. And there are many, many different habitat models that exist for individual species, guilds, biodiversity, and those can be applied spatially to a landscape in the context of before and after or with and without conservation practices like conservation buffers. An example of that is Sandelman here, 2006, identified a suite of desired focal species and applied habitat models to the landscape with and without, and then used basically the sum across all the species of the change in relative habitat value or percent of the area that reflected quality habitat as an index to change, to assess where the most impactful places to put those conservation practices are. Another example here, Gary Bentrip and his colleagues used connectivity as their measure of habitat quality, and their goal was, let's identify the places in the landscape where, given if we put 5% of the landscape in conservation buffers, where should we put that 5% to get the greatest increases in connectivity. Now, I want to think about a third concern, not just the water quality, optimizing from a water quality standpoint or optimizing from a wildlife standpoint, but what about optimizing from an economic standpoint for the producer? Conservation practices, when adopted by producers, those are multidimensional decisions that are influenced by time and management and profits and yields. And unfortunately, among producers, a riparian buffer practice is not one of their favorite practices, is reflected by Osmond here. They found that the producers just don't like riparian buffers for a number of reasons, in part because they don't generate, they don't offset the opportunity costs of implementation, and in some cases they interfere with their production systems. When you look at motivations of private landowners as identified by K et al. In 2004, the top motivations in their decision-making process relate to staying in business and running a profitable business. Not that they don't want to be a good steward. They do, clearly. It's in the top 10 as a priority, but it's not the first factors that affect their decision-making process. And so when we, from a conservation standpoint, ask a producer to adopt a practice, if he doesn't clearly see how that's going to impact the profitability of the operation, then it's hard for him to justify making that decision. And whenever a producer makes an allocation of time, energy, or land to a use that protects or enhances environmental resources, that involves economic trade-offs for him. And it produces a societal benefit: clean water, clean air, reduced erosion. But the cost of that is incurred by the private individual, and that creates an asymmetry in costs and benefits. And producers, unless they're compensated, have a hard time rationalizing that in their business model. And so We can take the same geospatial tools and precision ag tools that we use to inform our agricultural operations and our conservation placement and apply those to economic decision support as well to help the producer make informed decisions about where conservation practices make not only environmental sense but also economic sense. And so we developed a geospatial tool that uses common precision ag data layers to do two things. One is to help a producer visualize on his landscape where conservation practice eligibility occurs. That is, where is there a conservation practice that I can adopt that fits? And secondly, to help a producer understand what the economic opportunity costs of that enrollment are going to be. And so the software tools, the decision support tool, is simply a script that runs in the toolbox in ArcGIS. And the first part of it, illustrating the conservation eligibility, simply uses standard-based layers like NHD and the soils layer and CLU data layer, as well as spatial criteria of a number of different USDA Farm Bill conservation practices like riparian forest buffers, filter strips, upland habitat buffers, CP23, and so they can pick the CRP practice or the conservation practice, and then they can point to where these source data layers are that are standard data layers, and then it will show in their landscape, for whether it's a field, a farm, or a county, where the eligible areas are. So helping a producer visualize eligibility is the first step in helping them make an informed decision. Then the second step is helping them understand the relative cost of that conservation practice relative to what they were doing, their conventional production. And so halfway down the screen there, there's a checkbox that says compute profitability. And when you check that box, then it asks you for some other input layers, like where's your yield data and what ID, what field within the yield data has your yield in it, and what is your production cost, and what is the expected commodity price. And that tool will construct a simple production budget and then construct a break-even analysis, basically, and calculate net revenue under either current or alternative simulated enrollments. And so just to get right to it, just as an illustration, in the center of this screen is a soybean field in central Mississippi. And basically the green and the yellow areas are net positive profit regions, the red are net negative profit regions. And every field has some net negative profit regions in it. But the producer very often, even if he's looking at yield, he doesn't necessarily see where that net negative profit region is. And so this tool helps to visualize that, and then it, with some understanding about incentive rates and production costs and profitability, the producer can compare alternative enrollments. And so if you look at these surrounding slides or pictures, they illustrate adoption of a 30, 60, 90, 120-foot conservation buffer around this field to take out some of those net negative profit regions. And wherever it goes from red to yellow, that's a net increase in whole field profitability, basically. And we use this to look at a large number of fields across the North Mississippi landscape and basically showed that, on average, across the board, even where wider buffers weren't profitable, narrow buffers, 30 foot basically, were almost always profitable. And here's another illustration. That's a bean field in Tallahatchie County. It's got a water problem during winter and spring, obviously. A proposed enrollment, average yield is 60 bushels per hectare. That's the profit surface with that. The soil-specific soil rental rates determine what the rental rate for the enrollment is, would replace that net negative profit region with a profit in the range of $150 per hectare, taking this producer on that particular field from, under his current production system, an average of $177 net revenue per acre across the whole field to $186. And so the point is, Using the same precision ag tools to inform our conservation decisions can actually enhance producer profitability, and conservation doesn't have to be looked at as a loss of economic return. So summarizing, conservation achieves outcomes that we would all like to see, but it has to be compatible with profitability. Producers will enroll in conservation programs that address environmental concerns, given that they understand what the financial costs and benefits are. And so from a conservation planner standpoint, it behooves managers, landowners to implement conservation practices when the economic return outweighs that of the traditional cropping system, or where the environmental outcomes justify it. It's increasingly important as commodity prices go up, and the tools that we have in precision agriculture provide the same kinds of information we need to inform decision making. So decision support tools provide the necessary tools needed to make informed land management decisions for water, wildlife, and economics. Thank you, Jorge.